So you have a handout for this one in your pack, and if you just look inside, you'll find there's two pages on free will and neuroscience, what do old school and new wave studies show. And Al, as he explained last night, he's actually flown over from Florida State University to be with us over the weekend, and then I understand he's going off to St. Petersburg for another conference. Is that on free will as well?
Pretty much.
Yes, pretty much. Right. Well, we'll see. He'll find out whether the Russians are any freer than we are. But he's also, in addition to his teaching, he's done a couple of Templeton-funded research studies, and at the moment he's doing one on the philosophy and science of self-control. And you're just in the sort of first year of that, I think,
That's
at the moment.
Right, yeah.
Yes. So this, as you know, or you may know, the Templeton Foundation is very interested in what they call big questions, and the whole question of free will in philosophy and science is one of those big questions, and so it'll be very interesting to see what comes out of it. In the meantime, you may have seen my review of Al's book in the current issue of Network Review. It's a short book, Oxford University Press, which very clearly explains his views, which I'm sure is what he's going to be talking about this morning. Anyway, it's a great pleasure to welcome you here, Al, and thank you so much for making the trip across the pond to be with us.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So, as I mentioned last night, today I'm going to talk about three different kinds of neuroscience experiment that, according to some people, prove that there's no free will. And I think I just want to start by what got me interested in writing about this. Oh, I should say, too, I'm going to talk about three problems that all three of these kinds of experiments share in generating the conclusion that there's no free will. People who know this field and this literature sometimes want me to talk about other problems, too, but I'm going to try to do this in 45 minutes, so three problems, and then you'll have some that you want to mention, and we can talk about those. So what got me interested in writing about it is that some time ago, I started reading a lot of news articles saying that scientists had shown that there's no free will, and I wondered what effect that news had on lay folk. So they read in a newspaper, or they read online, you don't have free will, nobody does. Do they find it depressing or comforting, or do they just not believe it, or what? And I was worried about it. I was worried that people would find it sort of depressing and that it might actually encourage misbehavior, because now you think you're not in charge of what you do, so what the hell, go with your urges. And then in 2008, I saw the first published study of the effect of no free will news on lay folk. And it was done by Kathleen Voss and Jonathan Schooler, a pair of social psychologists in the U.S. And it was done with college students. Most psychology subjects are college students. And the students were divided into three groups. And one group read passages, actual scientific passages, saying there's no free will and sort of ridiculing free will. And another group read passages saying you have free will. And the third group read neutral passages. And then the next task that these students had in this experiment was supposedly to take a math quiz, and they were told that the programmer messed up so that if they didn't press the space bar right after the question showed up, you know, the math question, the answer would show up at the bottom of the screen. So if you don't press the space bar, you can cheat. And what happened is that the group that read the no free will passages cheated way more often than the other two groups. And the other two groups behaved basically the same, which is some evidence that belief in free will is a default belief. And then a year later, a friend of mine, also who works at Florida State, Roy Baumeister, did a study. And it was similar to this. He used two groups, and one group read no free will passages. You don't have free will. And the other group read neutral passages. And then their next task was to serve snacks to people who were about to walk into the room. And they were told two things about these people. They all really hate spicy food. They've told us that. And they have to eat everything you put on their plate. And one of the snack options was a jar of salsa labeled super hot. And the students who read the no free will passages doled out way more of the spicy salsa than the other group. Now that's aggressive behavior, right? You're sort of making people feel pain. And you might wonder what's going on there. Well, what might be going on is you lower their confidence in free will, and they think, hey, no free will, you can't blame me. They've got these aggressive urges and they act on them. So we do have now then hard evidence that that lowering people's confidence in free will, we can put it that way, increases misbehavior. And it's that kind of finding that actually motivates me to persist in this study. I can't think now of how many different things I've written on free will and science, but I know three books that I've written. They're listed at the bottom of the handout and tons of journal articles. I'm trying to persuade myself that it's time to move on to other topics, and really I'd better because I've got this self-control grant now, but we'll see. It might take me a while to move on. Let me read you two examples of quotations from the press suggesting that you don't have free will. I have a friend who collects these, and he's got, I don't know, 40 pages, but I just brought one page along because I like to travel light, and I'll read you just two quotations. The first one is from Science Now Daily News. It was 2008. Your mind might be made up before you know it. Researchers have found patterns of brain activity that predict people's decisions up to 10 seconds before they're aware they've made a choice. The result was hard for some to stomach because it suggested that the unconscious brain calls the shots, making free will an illusory afterthought. I'll actually talk about the study referenced there. And then here's one also from 2008, December. The article was called The Decider. It was in Science News. And here's the quotation. Free will is not the defining feature of humanness, modern neuroscience implies, but is rather an illusion that endures only because biochemical complexity conceals the mechanisms of decision-making. That's the kind of thing that worried me. Now, when I was writing my book, Effective Intentions, which was published in 2009, and it's on different kinds of scientific arguments that there's no free will, arguments from different fields, and I explain the experiments and reply to them. Anyway, while I was writing that book, I got this email out of the blue from someone I don't know, and I ended up putting it in the preface of that book after I got her permission to do that. And this is what she wrote. Dear Dr. Mealy, I recently purchased a DVD by Dr. Stephen Walensky. He explains from the point of view of neuroscience that there is no such thing as free will, as we can only perceive an action after it has already occurred. Can you please help me with this? I can understand that I don't know what thought will occur next, but that has already happened is beyond comprehension. Thank you, as I am in a lot of despair. Okay. And that is both cute and sad at the same time. And that, again, is the kind of response I was worried about. So, yeah, I can put away those notes, and now I'm on the handout. So what I want to do is to start with the neuroscience experiment that really got the no free will ball rolling. And it was done by a neurobiologist named Benjamin Libet, initially done in the early 1980s, and then we get newer and newer versions. Now, he used EEG. So there what you're doing is measuring electrical conductivity on the scalp and how it moves. But I'll also talk about free will experiments using fMRI, and I'll get to that in a little while, and then free will experiments using depth electrodes. My earlier grant from Templeton, it was a $4.5 million grant, was on free will and science. And we actually funded some neuroscience experiments on free will, some really interesting ones, some of which don't point the no free will way at all. So I might, well, maybe I'll save that for the discussion period. I might talk about that. Now, I am a philosophy professor, but I'm not really going to do any fancy philosophical stuff at all in my talk. I don't even have to talk much about what free will means. Because the way all three of these experiments are supposed to lead to the conclusion that there's no free will is by proving that, at least in the experiments, all the decisions made by the subjects are made unconsciously. So they don't make conscious decisions. The brain makes them unconsciously, and then the people become aware of them after they're made. I'll read you some quotations from Libet to set that up. And before that, just a little bit of, well, terminology, we'll call it. So on the handout, you see deciding and intentions. These studies are all about deciding and intentions, or they purport to be anyway. So think of a decision, this is how I think of it, this is how Libet thinks of it too, as a little action of forming an intention to do a thing. So I might decide now to snap my fingers now, and the deciding to do that is a little action I perform. And we'll leave it open that you could perform it unconsciously, which is what they claim, or consciously. Intentions you can understand however you normally do. It turns out most people mean the same thing by the word intention, so we don't have to go on about that. But among decisions and intentions, we need to distinguish between what I call proximal and distal. Now, a proximal intention is just an intention you have now to do something now, like an intention I have now to snap my fingers now. And a distal intention or decision is an intention or decision you have or make now to do something later. So just now I formed an intention to have another Stella beer. That was really good last night. With my meal tonight. So I have that intention now. That's a distal one. That's for tonight. It's not for now. And all of these studies are about proximal intentions and proximal decisions. They're all about intentions now to do things now or deciding now to do something now. In Libet's study, it's moving a wrist. That's what's going on. Okay, now, just some before I describe Libet's experiment, some claims Libet makes and also a claim by Soon and co-authors. This is on the handout. And this will let you see the line of reasoning that leads to the conclusion that there's no free will. So, Libet, the brain decides to initiate or at least prepare to initiate certain actions before there is any reportable subjective awareness that such a decision has taken place. That is, your brain decides unconsciously to do something before you become aware of what it has decided. And later on, under certain conditions, he thinks, you become aware of your brain's decision. Okay. Two, and this is from Soon and co-authors, because brain activity in the supplementary motor area consistently preceded the conscious decision, it has been argued that the brain had already unconsciously made a decision to move even before the subject became aware of it. So that's just repeating what Libet said in different terms, and Soon and co-authors use different technology too. They used fMRI. Back to Libet, if the act now process is initiated unconsciously, then conscious free will is not doing it. So he's saying really that if an action, a bodily action of yours is going to be free, it has to be generated by a conscious intention or a conscious decision. But we've just been told we make our decisions unconsciously. So we never act freely, with one kind of exception that I'll get to a little bit later. Somebody mentioned free won't last night, so that person at least knows what's coming up about that. But and then another claim by Libet, back to a 1985 paper, a famous paper in Behavioral and Brain Sciences. Our overall findings do suggest some fundamental characteristics of the simpler acts that may be applicable to all consciously intended acts and even to responsibility and free will. And what he's doing there is saying that he can generalize from what he thinks he finds in his studies, which I'm about to describe, to all decisions and all intentions and all actions. Okay, so now, the experimental design. So subjects were seated in a chair, and they're watching a very fast clock. There's a spot on it. Let's make it a hand, because these days they use a hand, that makes a complete revolution in about 2.5 seconds. And what they're supposed to do is flex their wrist whenever they want, and then after they flex, they're supposed to report where the spot was on the clock, when they first became aware of their intention, decision, urge, wish, or will to flex now. So it's a proximal intention, urge, wish, will. Different terms were used. I think Libba didn't want to tie them down. So you're taking EEG readings from the scalp, seeing what's going on just prior to the flexing, and you're measuring muscle motion too. Now, when subjects were regularly reminded to be spontaneous about their flexing, that is, not to plan in advance of when to flex, not to think about when to do it, just to be as random as they could be, what happened is that the EEG started ramping up at about 550 milliseconds, a little more than half a second, before muscle motion, but the average time of first reported awareness of the decision, intention, wish, will, or whatever, was 200 milliseconds before muscle motion. It was 206, we just round it. And so what Libet said is, well, look, what's going on is the brain is making the decision back here, and about a third of a second later, you, or the mind, becomes aware of it. So the decision is not made consciously, and so the action then that's generated by it, the flexing, isn't free. Okay? And that's how it's supposed to go. That's what Libet thought. Now, I said I would talk a little bit about free will, so I'll do that. Libet thought there was a kind of exception to this. And what he thought is that once you became conscious of your intention or urge or whatever to do a thing now, you could veto it. You could veto the urge or intention. Let's stick with intention. That's usually what he talked about. So I'm doing his experiment then, and I have this intention now to do it now. Now it's conscious, and I can veto it, he thinks. So there's a little window of opportunity for something like free will, but it's negative. He thought free will can never initiate a process, but it can shut it down. And the window of opportunity is open for 100 milliseconds. This is a tenth of a second. Because it's got to be between 200 milliseconds and muscle motion, and you're going to hit a point of no return in there somewhere. And Libet speculated it was about a tenth of a second before muscle motion. Now, he said he had two kinds of evidence for veto power. And one was anecdotal. After the experiment, quite a few subjects actually said, you know, every once in a while I had an urge to flex my wrist now, and I just canceled it. I didn't act on it. I waited for the next one to arise. But he also did what he thought of as a veto study. And the way that study worked is subjects were told to prepare to flex when the spot hit a certain point on the clock, but don't do it. And what he thought happened is, well, they would have an intention then to do it when the spot hit that point on the clock, but they wouldn't act on that intention, they would veto it. And while you can do EEG, and he did, while subjects were preparing and then not doing it. And what he discovered under this condition is that he got an EEG ramp up starting up about a second before the pre-designated time, say the 9 o'clock point. And it went up like this, and about 150 to 250 milliseconds before the pre-designated time, it petered out. And there, you know, there was no muscle motion. The people didn't flex. And so he said, hey, look, I found it. This is evidence of veto power. These people intended to flex their wrists when the spot hit the 9 o'clock point, and then they canceled that intention, and they didn't do it. Now, so that's his little window for free will. This window isn't so good. It's good to have free will where we hope it is. But let me explain to you something that goes wrong in this experiment. And actually, I can explain it with my own little hands-on experiment that we can all do, and you can just sort of see it from the inside instead of lots of words. So we'll try it. So what I want you to do is to prepare to snap your fingers like this. When I get to three, I'm going to count one, two, three, but don't do it, okay? And I want you to pay attention to what's going on in your head while you're preparing to snap your fingers. And remember now, the idea is don't do it, just prepare. Okay, so here we go. One, two, three. Excellent. So, how many people intended to snap when I got to three? Nobody, right? If you had, you would have done it. What you intended to do was to gear up to do it and not do it. And maybe you had to think a bit about what gearing up was, or maybe you were thinking, oh, I'm not even going to pay any attention. But just as you didn't intend to snap your fingers when I got to three, the subjects in Libet's experiments didn't intend to flex their wrists when the spot hit the 9 o'clock point. What they intended to do was something like simulating intending and then not going along with it. Okay, I'll come back to that later. Now, at this point, I'm always tempted to launch into the critique of Libet, but I consciously remind myself to go on to the next experiment and then the third. And notice this is conscious. You can tell because I'm talking, right? And then go on to the third, and then I'll do the critique. So the next experiment is done with fMRI. As you know, fMRI measures changes in blood oxygen levels in the brain. Blood flow is a little slow to where it has just been used the most, but three seconds or so afterwards, you can tell which parts of the brain were most active when something or other was going on. Now, the task here was to press a button, either the left button or the right button. And they're in a scanner, so blood flow is being measured, and they're supposed to be as random as possible, just like in Libet's study. They're not supposed to think in advance about when to do it. And after a lot of training and a lot of recording, the experimenters are able to predict with high accuracy, they say that's a quotation, 7 to 10 seconds in advance, which button the person will press next, the left one or the right one. Okay, now that sounds pretty impressive. 7 to 10 seconds in advance. Okay, we'll get back to that. That's the second one, and that was the second type of technology. So now we've switched from EEG to fMRI. And then the third kind of experiment is done with depth electrodes or electrode grids. So epilepsy patients who, in the end, can't successfully be treated by drugs, often opt for surgery. And to do this kind of surgery, a part of the skull has to be removed. And then, if the patients want to, they can participate in neuroscience experiments. I funded one of these. It was a wonderful experiment. And so then you can take recordings directly from the brain, either with electrode grids on the brain or with electrodes implanted a bit into the brain. So this is, you know, really high accuracy stuff because you're recording right from the brain. Now, in this study by Fried and colleagues, the subjects are supposed to click a button whenever they want. And the scientists are reading and they're making predictions in real time, which usually is not the case. And they're trying, these guys actually are trying to predict what time the subjects will say was the time at which they first became aware of the intention or urge. But that time is pretty consistently followed by muscle motion a tenth of a second later, and by switch closure, where the key is pressed all the way down, another tenth of a second later. So you could say they're predicting switch closure. You could say they're predicting muscle motion. Let's say switch closure. So they're predicting that 9/10 of a second in advance with 80% accuracy. So that's pretty impressive. Okay, now in that paper by Fried and co-authors, no claims are made about free will. But when the press got a hold of this article, it was cited a lot in connection with the claim that you don't make any of your decisions consciously, so you don't have free will. And then later on, maybe partly because of all the press attention, Gabriel Kreiman, who was one of the co-authors, has started on the no free will bandwagon. These are all really nice people, you know, with good motivation and so on. We're all after the truth. It's not as though they're trying to do something else, but I don't think it's true, and it's, I think, also a dangerous falsehood that we don't have free will. Okay, so I've talked about three different kinds of experiment, and now our question is, do they show that we don't have free will? You know how the argument's supposed to go. All three experiments are claimed to support the idea that Those subjects don't make their decisions consciously. And then what happens is they want to generalize from those cases to all of us all the time, so nobody ever makes a conscious decision. And if nobody ever makes a conscious decision, then it looks like nobody has free will. Okay? That's how it goes. So one problem is, or here's a question. So what happens at these earlier times? Say, what happens at minus 550 milliseconds in a Libet study? Or what happens at minus 7 to 10 seconds in the fMRI study? Or what happens at 9/10 of a second in advance of muscle motion in the depth electrode study? So let's start with this one. What happens at minus 550 milliseconds? Well, Libet says that what happens is that as soon as you get that beginning of the ramp-up, EEG ramp-up, that's when the decision is made, and it's made unconsciously. So one question we should have then is that right? Is that when the decision is made, or is something else going on there? Now, one really simple kind of question to ask to get at this, to get information about it, is how long does it take a proximal decision or intention, a decision or intention to do something now, to generate muscle motion? Does it take 550 milliseconds? Does it take less time? Does it take more time? Now, one way to get indirect evidence about this is with reaction time tests. And so in a reaction time test, people know what they're supposed to do when they get the go signal, and it could be, you know, flex a wrist, and you just see how long it takes between the sounding of the go signal, if it's a tone, often it's a tone, and muscle motion. And what you'd want to get data that really would apply very well to the Libet study is a reaction time study done where the subjects are watching a clock. Because if you're watching a clock and trying to keep track of it, and you're listening for a tone and waiting to do the thing you're supposed to do, your attention is divided between those two tasks, and it's going to slow down reaction time. Well, so this was quite a long time ago when I didn't have any grant money, and I don't have a lab because I'm a philosopher, right? So I can't do my own experiments, although now I can pay people to do them, which is really good. So I just looked and looked until I found a reaction time study using a Libet clock, and I found one. And what I found is that the mean time between the sounding of the go signal and the beginning of muscle motion was 231 milliseconds. So now if what goes on in a reaction time test is you get the go signal, that generates an intention to do it now, which then generates muscle motion, the mean time between intention and muscle motion is going to be less than 231 milliseconds because it's going to take time for the intention to generate anything. And so we're in the ballpark of the W time, 200 milliseconds. In my book, Effective Intentions, I suggested that another way to get evidence about this, and this too was before I had grant money, was to do a kind of decide signal task, where what you do is you tell subjects, it can be left button and right button, don't make your decision until you hear the decide signal, and then, right then, you decide, and then you press. Okay, so you press in response to your own decision. You don't make the decision until you hear the decide signal. Well, a study like this was done, but this is on the handout, by Trevina and Miller a year later. And one thing they discovered is that when you measure EEG before the decide signal is issued, there's no difference between the trials in which they press left and the trials in which they press right, which is evidence that no decision was made before the signal sounded, so that the subjects were doing what you wanted. And the mean time between signal and muscle motion was about 150 milliseconds. So if the decision was made after the signal, the time between decision and muscle motion was less than 150 milliseconds, and we're in here, right? We're way closer to zero than to minus 550. So that is good reason to believe that what Libet gets at the beginning of the ramp-up isn't correlated with a decision that's already been made. It's correlated with something else, and it's evidence that the decision is made around here. Okay. Now that, right, destroys the claim that the decision's made unconsciously, because that's based on the supposition that it's made back here at minus 550. Okay, good. Now, let's go on to the fMRI study. So remember, 7 to 10 seconds in advance, they said they were able to predict with high accuracy which button, left or right, the person would press next. Now, it turns out that if you look at the, well, statistics, the high accuracy was 60%. Now, 60% is statistically significant, but, you know, it's not all that impressive. And just to get a feel for how unimpressive really it is, I can predict with a fair coin with 50% accuracy way in advance whether a person's going to press the left button next or the right button. And if I got the person to promise not to press for a minute, I could do this a minute in advance with 50% accuracy. So I could beat the heck out of them on time, right? And they would just do better on reliability. So the 60% figure certainly can't show that decisions have already been made at that earlier time. And what I think is going on, and there are some people who agree, is that given the task, what's going to happen is that you're going to develop from time to time a little bias one way or the other. It's sort of a nudge, like you're unconsciously leaning toward the left button next time or toward the right button next time, because you're not supposed to fall into any patterns and so on. And I think that's going to generate these little inclinations that don't come up to consciousness. But that's nothing like forcing you to do a thing. It's just a nudge. Okay. And then what happens at minus 700 milliseconds in the depth electrode study? Well, now here the prediction accuracy is 80%, which again is impressive. But given the evidence we have that I went through in talking about the Libet stuff, about how long it takes for a proximal intention to generate muscle motion, it looks like what we have at minus 700 or 800 or 900 milliseconds isn't going to be yet an intention to do the thing now, because then the muscle motion would happen a lot earlier. So it looks like it's part of a process that is increasing the probability of an intention arising soon. Something like that, something that's going to lead up to an intention. I can talk more about that later, because there are a lot of other studies that bear on it. Okay, so that was problem one. Should we, and the question there really was, should we say that the decisions are being made unconsciously at those earlier times, or is it more likely that the decisions are made later, closer to the time of action? And everything I told you is pointing toward the latter, that if there are decisions or intentions, they're proximal ones, they're pretty close to the time of action, and not even as far back as minus 550 milliseconds. Now, that's a point I've been making for a few years, and sometimes the reply is, well, you know, maybe you're right about that. The decisions aren't made that early, and the intentions don't come up that early, but sometimes I'm told the point of no return is hit that early. So by the time, let's say Libet's study, by the time you get here, they say, even if the decision hasn't been made yet, it has to be made down here. There's no way to stop the process. No way, barring, you know, shooting the subject in the head or whatever. Something that you only do in philosophy classes. Okay, so that's what they say. Now, so one thing you could ask is, say, the electrical activity there. Is that, once you get into that region, have you hit the point of no return so that the process can't be stopped? That would be the question. Now, it turns out that from Libet's own studies, there's a quotation about this on the handout, you can't get evidence about the point of no return. And that's because he used muscle motion as the signal to trigger the computer to make a record of the preceding second or so of brain activity. Now, let me explain what's going on here. So if you want to know whether the point of no return is hit in there, what you have to do is to look for cases in which you have an EEG ramp-up that looks like that, and then look to see whether there's a muscle burst or not. And if you found cases where you get a ramp-up like that, but you get no muscle burst, then you'd think, okay, well, then the point of no return hasn't been hit, because you've got a ramp-up, and you don't get that result. But now, as I mentioned, Libet uses the muscle motion as the trigger to send the computer a signal to say, hey, make a record of that. So it's only when there was muscle motion that you get the EEG. So you can't look to see whether the point of no return has been hit. Now, you might be thinking, oh, but what about that Beto study where there was no muscle motion and he generated EEG? Well, he did that because he had a place to measure back from, and that was the pre-designated time. Okay, but in this main study, he's not measuring back from anything but the muscle motion. So Libet doesn't generate evidence that the point of no return is hit there. He can't, given his method. And in the case of the other studies, all we have are these probabilities, 60% or 80%, at times back here. But 60% and 80% are not evidence that the point of no return has been hit. They're evidence of the probability of something happening later. And if it's just a probability, well, then it may or may not happen. Which, you know, for free will people is important because they like that sort of latitude, right? It might happen, it might not. It's open. Okay. Third problem. I wonder how I'm doing on time. I think I can do this. I said 45 minutes. I'm going to come close. So suppose now that these guys are right and I'm wrong and that all the decisions and intentions in these studies were unconscious. They were all unconsciously made or acquired and then the people became aware of them later. Suppose they're right about that. Can they properly generalize from that finding, that alleged finding, to all decisions and all intentions? Okay, that's the question. And recall that Libet does this. I quoted it earlier. So I think here to see what's going on, it helps me to talk about my own experience as a subject in a Libet experiment. So years ago, it was actually 10 years ago now, I gave a lecture to the National Institutes of Health, to a motor control unit there headed by Mark Hallett, who's a really nice guy. And the deal was, I would give my lecture, then I would be a subject in a Libet experiment, and then they would take me out to dinner. So I gave my lecture, and then it was time to be a subject in the experiment, and I sat down and I got wired up, and I was waiting for urges, really, to flex soon, to pop up so that I could respond to them and flex and then report where the spot was on the clock when the urge popped up. And what I discovered after sitting there for just a little while is nothing like that was happening in my head. So I had no urges to flex now, no, I didn't make any decisions or no intentions, nothing like that. And so I had two questions for myself. And one was, how do these subjects do this? You know, where do they get the mental thing that drives it all? And then what am I going to do? And I was partly getting hungry and partly I didn't want to look like a jerk. So what I decided to do was to say now silently to myself, treat that as a go signal. I've already talked about go signals. And then flex in response to the silent now saying. You know, that was my strategy. And the point I want to emphasize is that I think this was hard for me, this task, because it was just arbitrary picking. I could pick this moment to say now silently to myself, or that moment, or the next one. It's just arbitrary. Which leads into Buridan's ass. A lot of you probably know about Buridan's ass. So it's a hyper-rational donkey. And being hyper-rational, it cannot do one thing or another unless it has a reason to prefer it to the other, and really to every other option. So he's got to have a reason to prefer this to everything else in order to do this. And one day the donkey is wandering around in the woods or wherever donkeys wander, and it finds itself midway between two equally attractive, equally large bales of hay. And so it looks to the left and it looks to the right. And it can't think of any reason to prefer this one to that one or that one to this one, and so it starves to death. It just stands there and starves to death. And that's because the donkey can't just arbitrarily pick. We are in this situation a lot, and we have automatic tiebreakers to help us with it. So in the U.S., you know, you go to a supermarket, and you want, let's say, a 16-ounce jar of Planters peanuts, and you go to the peanut display, and there are thousands of them. And if you were to try to decide, figure out which jar is better than the other when they're all the same, you know, you drive yourself nuts. So what you do is you just go in and you just go in and pick. Yeah, I don't have good delivery time, so he saved that one. That was good. You would just pick. Okay. Now, there are some philosophers who think you don't have free will in situations like that. Free will is only for situations in which you're torn about what to do. Often they think it's got to be torn between moral considerations and self-interest, or torn between your own long-term self-interest and your short-term desires, and you struggle over it, and so on. There are philosophers like that. They're called restrictivists. That's why restrictivism is on the handout. And then there are other philosophers who say, oh no, you can have free will even in arbitrary picking cases. But the point I want to make is that those two kinds of case are really very different. And the more different they are, the harder it is to generalize from findings about arbitrary picking to findings about, you know, these torn cases where you're soul searching and struggling. So just to give you an example, how similar is my arbitrary picking of a moment to say now to somebody's decision made after months and months of reasoning about whether it was time finally to request the divorce or time finally to retire or, you know, whatever. And notice that in Libet studies and all the studies I talked about, all the neuroscience studies, subjects are told not to think in advance about when to do it or what to do. You know, it depends on whether it's a timing thing or this button or that. So that conscious thinking is shoved off to the side. But when conscious thinking is involved in decision making, that makes it much more likely that the decision itself will be made consciously because it's coming out of or after at least a conscious process. Okay, so well, time to wrap it up, my conclusion. So one thing I showed is that the findings don't show that decisions are made unconsciously, even by those subjects in those experiments. They don't even show that. The findings don't show that the point of no return is hit that early. If the point of no return were hit that early, you might think, okay, everything's out of our hands before we become conscious of what we decided. But the findings don't show that the point of no return is hit that early. And there is no legitimate way to generalize from the findings about arbitrary picking to a conclusion about all decisions, including ones that are preceded by conscious deliberation. Okay, and that's it. Forty-six minutes, that was pretty good.
Very good, really excellent. Thank you so much for that really clear exposition. If our table's anything to go by, some really interesting questions coming up. So who would, we've got two microphones? One, yeah, two. So who'd like to decide to have the first question? We've got Paul here, and then we've got a question here.
Oh, my goodness.
Impulse control.
I'd like to ask one question. We're interested in what is called the presentiment effect, the sort of experiments done by Dean Radin and colleagues, where the claim is that this is involving a sort of precognitive effect, which obviously most scientists are very skeptical about, and maybe some philosophers are also skeptical about. But the idea is that they in some sense anticipate the some image which is shown by, again, some number of 100 milliseconds or something. No, more like a few seconds. And you have exactly a very similar effect. You have a sort of ramp-up effect. The claim is that before the erotic image is shown, that the brain has a sort of response. And this is claimed as evidence of precognition. But in some sense, it's rather similar to the Liebe effect, except the Liebe effect doesn't involve any paranormal functions. So I'll be interested in how you respond to that.
Yeah, it sounds like priming to me, but I have to get clearer on what happens. So they show something, a slide, say, and the brain is reacting to it before they think the person could be aware of it? Is that what's going on? Yeah.
It's a second.
Yeah, that sounds like priming. So you can do that, and you can mask the prime too, so you show something else right after it, and people won't be aware of the original prime in the sense that they won't be able to report on it, but it will have an effect on their behavior.
No priming. Because the effect is observed before the picture has been randomly selected by computer.
Oh, my God. Okay. I've got it.
If I can,
I don't understand how that could happen.
One moment. If I can just clarify it. Here's the experiment. You have a subject who's going to be shown about 100 slides.
Okay.
Mixed in between, most of them are like trees, flowers, people, fairly neutral. And mixed in with them is a slide of someone with their head chopped off or a couple copulating or something like that. Okay. Now, if you follow the EEG pattern, nothing happens as they watch one from the other. But just before they are about to be shown the one which has a great emotional value, there's a big kick in the EEG pattern.
Well, it sounds like backward causation. We're going to get a talk on backward causation, aren't we? So let's hold off on that for the backward causation talk. My goodness, that's amazing.
It's you here.
Yes, I've always, for a long time, wondered about the sorts of studies that you're talking about, and when the students are brought in and then given these sorts of tasks, that isn't there a built-in problem in that there's a sort of context of compliance, mm-hmm. that the people aren't really, in some sense, using their own free will, that they're doing what they've been told by the authority figure who's the researcher. And isn't that going to change things? You know, I'm thinking in particular of Roy Baumeister, mm-hmm. Where he puts the students in front of a big table of, you know, food, and there's chocolate muffins and there's carrot sticks, and he says, you can only eat the carrot sticks.
Yeah.
And then finds later that the people who've done that have all eaten tons of chocolate. More chocolate than others. But the whole premise is that that's based on I am following instructions rather than freely choosing for myself.
Okay. Well, let me tell you a bit about that study. So that's a different Baumeister study than the one I talked about. It's a self-control study, and it's interesting. So the way it works is, in the first condition, some of the subjects can eat the brownies, and some can't eat the brownies. They can only eat the carrots. And then Roy has the brownies baking in the room where those carrot subjects are, and he's got fans blowing the brownie odor toward those people. And so they're smelling these wonderful brownies and they're eating these miserable carrots. Okay, so that's task one. And then in task two, there's this puzzle-solving thing that they do, and the puzzles are actually unsolvable. And what you do is you see whether using your willpower to avoid the brownies and just eat the carrots, what effect that has on your puzzle solving, how long you persist at solving puzzles. And what had the short version is, the people who ate the brownies persisted way longer at solving the puzzles than the people who just ate the carrots. And Roy's idea was, what happens is your willpower is depleted on the first task because you have to resist your urge to eat the brownies and you don't have enough left to persist long in the puzzle solving. So it's not as though the subjects are being obedient. In fact, what Roy thinks is they're burning up a lot of glucose in resisting the temptation to eat the brownies, and so they just don't have enough to persist very long on the next one.
Well, there are studies that say that glucose isn't depleted.
I know these studies.
But yeah. The other thing is, isn't it all within a context of I'm telling you what to do rather than it actually coming from my own, you know, my own reasons? There's still a compliance factor, surely.
I think in some studies there is. I don't really see the factor here because we're not testing to see whether they're going to just eat the carrots. What we're testing to see is whether if they just eat the carrots and don't eat the brownies, they do less well on the next task.
Maybe even if it's just flexing a wrist, I'm still doing what I've been told to do rather than my own.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Yeah, and that what I see. Some people say that. What Libet is thinking is, well, right, you know, you're going to have to flex your wrist because I told you to do that. But it's up to you when you do it. So you have freedom about the time of doing it. Or in the Soon study, you're going to press a button because I told you to do that, but it's up to you which one. So there's a little, you know, wiggle room or latitude, little room for freedom in these experiments. The tasks are always trivial, and that's important. You know, flex the wrist, press a button, doesn't matter which one you press, because that raises this generalization problem. So they're making a move from decisions about trivial things that don't matter to important things, right? So the experimenters are leaving some room for freedom. Like if the experiment was this, press the button when the spot hits the 9 o'clock point or I'll kill you, you know, then there would be no room
for freedom at all. Or I was going to say, I'll give you $100.
Oh, yeah. So press it and I'll give you $100.
I've got a reason to press. I've got a reason to press it. That's my reason.
Oh, the $100. Oh, so you think so. Yeah, see, some people would think, well, if you get $100 for pressing this button and nothing for pressing that one, then it's such a no-brainer that it isn't a free decision. So there are people who go different ways. I think I'm with you on that. That can be free, but that opens a big can of worms.
Let's move on. Where's the microphone? We've got Michael over here, I think, and... Who else had a hand up? And Eddie, okay. And then, Aileen, we'll go back, and then Marilyn. So Aileen in the back.
Thank you very much. I think you've convinced me, if I needed convincing, that the arguments of Libet and other deterministic arguments are fallacious. But the problem with this, as I see it, is rather like the old problem between the via positiva and the via negativa. It's fairly easy to say that if we have free will, it is not the same as this, that, and the other. Mm-hmm. But as soon as one tries to say more positively what free will is, one runs into a systematic difficulty. Because after making what I regard as the free choice, I then give reasons for it. Those reasons start looking as if they are things that I was arguably forced to do. And yet that already sucks me into the inappropriate via negativa. And my only solution myself is to say that if the phenomenon of consciousness is taken really seriously, our answer has to be in terms of phenomenology and the rest of the conscious life, not in terms of the kind of mechanistic reasons that would normally be given for why did you do this. But there's a systematic difficulty in giving a positive account of what free will is.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, now notice that in this talk, I didn't have to say much about what free will is because the road to the conclusion that there's no free will went through the claim that in the studies, the subjects make their decisions unconsciously. And I was able to show that the data don't support that. But you're absolutely right to ask, so what does free will mean anyway? I mean, that's one way to put it. You know, I've written theoretical books on free will, too. And I have an unusual position. I don't know how much you want to hear about the theoretical stuff, but in philosophy, there's a big divide between compatibilism about free will and incompatibilism about free will. And the compatibilists say, even if determinism is true, people can have free will. But determinism is understood in a very precise way in this literature. It's understood as it is in physics. So to say that a universe is deterministic is to say that a complete description of the laws of nature and a complete description of the state of the universe at any point in time entails all other truths, logically entails all other truths about the universe. So that it's sort of, the idea would be it's all unfolding and there's only one way it can unfold. And some philosophers say, well, even if it's like that, people can have free will because what is free will? What is it? And they say... Well, this is sufficient for it anyway. If you're sane and rational and not being pushed around, well-informed, make a conscious decision on the basis of good information, you've got free will. And you can have that even in a deterministic universe. Now, I can tell you wouldn't go for that one. I'm neutral about it because I want to give something to the incompatibilists, too. Now, what do they need? Well, they need that determinism not be true, so they need that it be open to you sometimes at the moment of decision-making, that although you decided to do one thing, let's say press this button, everything being the same right up until then, you could have decided to press that other button with no changes, right? So that if you could roll time back, like 10 seconds, and roll it forward, nothing changes, until the moment of decision, and this time you make the other decision, you would need that for free will. So I have a theory of free will that accommodates that, too. There aren't many philosophers who think this anymore, but there are some who think that you actually need to go even beyond the indeterminism and you need a soul or something that isn't bound by laws of nature. It's too deep for me. I am a philosopher, but I can be out of my depth. And once we start talking about things that I don't know how to study, scientifically, really, I shut up because it's too easy to get into trouble.
Be that Eddie's going to take you right there.
Okay, that's too bad.
No, I don't know.
Can you hear?
Yeah.
Right, well, without entering a semantic minefield, I think we might be slightly confusing free will with free fall. I mean, a stone falling down from a height is in free fall. Mm-hmm. Real free will surely implies awareness and discipline and choice. But my question is, in all of these studies, was there any consideration of context dependency? Because if one looks at one's life, there are expanding realms in which in one sphere one has far more control and awareness, and as one steps into a wider sphere of being, one is far more fated, so to speak. So was there any context dependency? And my second question is, who or what is the I that becomes conscious of the brain's decision?
Okay, good. No, good. Yeah, the second one does get us there. So the first one, the context dependency, no. It's always trivial choices that are being studied. Which time to do a thing, or this button or that button. And I have suggested, and some people are starting to do studies in which something does hang on it, like if you press the left button, you donate a certain amount of money to one charity. If you press the right button, money goes to another charity. Or you can do press the left button, money goes to you, like 10 cents or so. Press the right button, money goes to charity. You can do this, and you can do fMRI, and you can see if there's any difference, between these kinds of cases and the arbitrary picking. Now, who is the I? So I'm actually what you could think of as a minimalist about the self. There is a whole field of, the self in philosophy and in psychology, too. And people ask me, what my view is on that, like, who is the self? And I say, exactly what do you mean? What are you asking me? Like, who am I? And or who are you? And they say, well, I'm asking you who I am, who they are. And I say, well, go find a full-length mirror. You go look there, and that's you. And that is my deflationary view about the self, that the I there is the whole organism, the whole organism. Now, that's not to say that there's nothing spiritual. If there is, it's going to be integrated into the whole organism, but that integrated thing isn't going to be you. You're going to be who we all think you are, the guy you see in a mirror, full length. Because if you're looking in just the top, it's not all of you, right? It's just part. People don't like this. I like it because it's simple.
Well, that will be the cause of further discussion, I think. So you can elaborate that if you get Al on your lunch table.
Yeah, right.
Well, you won't see all of him on the table, not just the top part. So now, Aline.
Thank you. It's just a naive question. I think partly been answered by the previous speakers, but it seems to me that if, as a lot of people in this room think, we are one whole, there's an inner self, an outer self, a higher self, a lower self, I don't quite see the value of the experiment, because if you're saying, you know, in other words, the differentiation between conscious and unconscious or subconscious brain, why can't the subconscious brain have free will? In other words, so how far back do you go? You know, if it's starting 500 milliseconds before you then get to the conscious part and the motor response, I don't see why there's any difference between it. It's not determining free will.
Okay. No. Yeah, right. So one assumption in all of this literature is that if it isn't consciously made, the decision, it isn't freely made. And what you're saying is, well, explain to me why a decision has to be freely made in order to be consciously made. There's no argument for that in the scientific literature. It's assumed because, it sounds plausible, right? Could unconscious decisions be free? Yeah, actually, I think so. But, that's a long story. What about unconscious intentions? So forget about decisions for a second, intentions. They're different things because decisions are mental actions and intentions are just states of mind. So when you're, if you drive a lot and you have good driving habits and you're driving around town, you signal for your turns before you make them. And the way I see it, you've got an intention to signal for it before you make it. And in my case, anyway, that intention isn't conscious. I'm paying attention to other things, not that. And that's just a system sort of playing off in a very routine way. And I'd be happy to say that my signaling is free, even though it wasn't generated by a conscious intention, and that the intention is free. It's part of a routine that I freely built up over many years. So I'm okay with that. Some people will say I'm wrong, and then you get into kind of deep arguments. But I'm not opposed at all to your suggestion. I don't want to bypass the scientific arguments that way, because that's doing it on theoretical grounds. I like to do it on their own turf. Do they justify the empirical claim they make that all decisions are made unconsciously? I show they don't. That's more convincing to them than anything theoretical would be.
Right, we have two more questions, and I can see one over there, and where's the next one going? Last one. Marilyn? John? Anyway.
Hello? Hello, yes.
We can hear you.
Good. I have an experience that happened about 20 years ago when I was walking on ice in the road. I slipped, fell down, face down on the ground. But automatically I
can
put
you
my
point
right
the,
hand.
Point your mouth towards the... But the
can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah, very well.
Right.
Yeah.
So I went to the hospital and the guy, jokingly, my arm was in an S-bend. He said to me, why did you put your hand in front of you? I didn't do that, I said. Yeah, but you are lucky that nature made you do that.
Yeah.
Because you would be smashing your face if you didn't put your hand in front of you.
Yeah.
How is that explained?
That we're built that way?
We are
built
that
way. Is that the
question? Yes, yeah. Exactly. Thank you.
I don't know. I suppose it's an evolved trait. That's my guess.
Well, it obviously has survival value.
Yeah.
Otherwise you wouldn't be here.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Thank you. Let's just go on to John here, and then we'll just fit Marilyn in right at the end.
Yes, this is just a very quick point. It may be a red herring, but experimental detail that I'm aware that it's possible, say, for an instrumentalist in an orchestra to follow a conductor's baton very accurately, or a dancer follow music very accurately, but the latency between the clock that the observer is watching and when the observer thinks where the clock is,
yeah.
and where he thinks the neurons jump in his brain. That there's something that isn't observable here externally, except by, if there's any latency between when the It's in the part of the loop between watching the clock and the experience.
No, I understand. Remember I said at the beginning I'm only going to talk about three problems? That's another one that I sometimes do talk about. So it's really about the accuracy of these W times, you know, the subject's reports and when they first became aware of the intention or decision or whatever. So what they're doing is they're watching a clock, so there's one kind of mental image they have, a perceptual image, and then they're looking into their heads, as it were, for the decision or intention, and then they have to map these two things up. They have to match them together. And it's really hard, even with a light and a tone, to match them up, to tell whether the tone sounded at the same time as the light flashed. And when you're looking in your head for something like an urge, or you don't really know what it is, an intention, a decision, it's hard to identify it, for one thing, and then hard to align it with your perception of the clock. And if you look at, so I gave you averages, right? Average is 200 milliseconds before muscle motion. But if you look at the raw data within subjects, the guesses from trial to trial about when W time was are all over the place. And so it is evidence of guessing. When I did it myself, you know, when I was the subject, I knew what I was looking for in my head because it was silently saying now to myself. That's simple, right? It's now. I know what that's like. And trying to map that onto my perception of the clock, the best I could do was pick about 20%, 25% of the clock and think, well, I said now somewhere in there. And then I just picked the middle point. So there's quite a bit of guesswork. And the less clear it is to the subjects what they're looking for in their heads, decision, intention, wish, will, what are those things, the more unreliable the data are going to be. Yeah, so absolutely, that's another problem. It's an important one.
Thank you. Last question or observation from Marilyn.
Is this working?
Yeah.
It's back to the free won't. Mm-hmm. The idea that you can have a stimulus to perform a specific task and immediately cancel that mm-hmm. task. I just feel that's really strong. The free will is the best evidence for free will for me.
Oh, I see. It would be nice if we didn't just have free won't, but we also had free will, because free won't is just stopping power, right? So you have an impulse and you stop it from generating
and
action.
And decide to do something else.
And then do you decide to do something else freely? If you do, then you have free will.
Yes,
but
that happens. That can happen.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, sure, it does happen.
And just a quick question, because I really find neuroscience very hard to understand. Is the activity in the brain specific for the task to be performed, or could it be a preparation or state of readiness for changing activity? But because before you decide to do something, you're already doing something, even if it's just sitting in a chair.
Yeah, sure.
And then there's a sort of intention to do something else.
Yeah.
And that's when you measure the brain activity. But is that brain activity specifically identifying the task that you're about to do, or is it just activity?
I don't think it's specific to the task, no. I think what you get in these studies really is preparation. So you're sort of preparing to do something soon, like flex a wrist, press this button, press that button. I don't think it's specific. And then if you're thinking about brain regions, well, with EEG, you're just measuring electricity that, you know, leaks up to the scalp, so it's not so specific. With the depth electrodes and so on, you are measuring, you know, pretty specific stuff. But I think most of this is motor preparation. If you're doing a go signal test and I'm watching you and I know what you're supposed to do when the green light flashes and we're taking EEG from me watching you, we're going to get EEG that looks sort of like that. And I'm not going to do anything. I'm just expecting you to do a thing, right? So that's some evidence of the non-specificity of these signals.
Thank you very much. Well, I think you'll agree that we've had a really fine unpacking of these experiments and their implications, because the Libet experiments have been around 30 years, and I imagine they've been rumbling in the background of many of our minds, and in what exactly are the implications. And I think the strength of philosophy that Al has given us this morning, you know, actually looks at the assumptions, looks at the procedures, looks at the setup, looks at alternative explanations based on these decision experiments and puts it in a wider context. And so I think I, for one, feel greatly or better informed on this topic than I did at the beginning. And I'd like you to join me in thanking Al for coming to contribute his wisdom to us.
Thank you.